Chapter 24, Baltimore, 1943. It was 1943 in calendar, and the quintuplets were finally moving home. They had turned 9 years old, and the public's fascination with their lives had continued unabated. The value of their estate was growing exponentially, and with it came increased lawsuits and countersuits from companies competing for their endorsements. The St. Lawrence Starch Company had shipped a case of their Beehive brand of corn syrup to the girls' home, then began advertising themselves as the ingredient of choice inside the Dion kitchen. A rival manufacturer, who was previously considered the corn syrup of choice for the quintuplets, sued for $150,000 as they saw their sales plummet. After months of court battles, a Dion nurse recollected from the stand measuring corn syrup from a can with the distinctive Beehive logo, an admission that put an end to the dramatic case. Others would continue in its place. Thanks to the tireless efforts of their father, the Canadian board that oversaw the girls' affairs finally relinquished control and allowed the family to reunite. Their new home was a huge manor the government paid to have built so that the Dions, now totaling 12, could live under one roof. Located nearby, it felt like a monstrosity, lacking any of the quaintness of their birth home or even the DeVoe nursery they'd spent their lives within. The transition was troubled from the start. The girls' other siblings had no relationship with them and were deeply jealous of their popularity. Even their mother seemed to show little joy at their return and immediately put them to work, confident their cushy life within the DeVoe nursery needed hardening through hours of chores and busy work. More stories of Emily's peculiar behavior began to surface. She had been the most magnanimous of them all, according to her sisters, quote, before illness set in and her nature seemed to turn in on itself, end quote, a description that would by now sound familiar to psychiatrists like Connor and Asperger. The consummate collector, Emily was fascinated with pencils, chalk, and butterflies, saving her specimens for later by stuffing them in her pockets. As a child, she was touched by the story of a hungry dog read to her at bedtime the night before. At the following breakfast, she took her bacon and placed it upon the illustration of the dog in the nursery book, a strange offering the nurses quickly put a stop to. In isolation, any of these behaviors might seem like inconsequential actions of an imaginative child. Over time, they began to paint a picture of someone who was dealing with something more alarming. One morning in the new home, Yvonne, who shared a room with Emily, awoke to find her sister lying motionless on her bed, eyes open, staring at the ceiling. She tried to rouse her, but Emily would not move. Her pale face began to turn blue, and Yvonne ran to get her sisters, her natural instinct to seek aid from the other quintuplets. They ran into the bedroom, but could do nothing for Emily, who had begun to tremble. They raced down the hall and screamed to their parents for help. "My God," their mother cried when she came into the room. "The Grand Mal." Emily was convulsing violently, a bloody foam forming at the corners of her mouth. They eventually used a spoon to pry her mouth open, allowing her to breathe. The girls begged their mother to allow them to call a doctor for help, and she finally relented, telling them, "Say only that she's sick. No details." Once Emily's seizures had passed, her mother tucked some blankets around her and told them, "Now no one will know anything happened. Leave her to rest." After what seemed like hours, Emily finally came around. She remembered nothing that had happened, but knew something serious had transpired given the terrible aching in her back and legs. Her sisters, reluctant to frighten her, described the attack. Emily was terrified, but their parents' request was resolute. No one was to know about what had happened. Emily's life had suddenly taken a turn for the worse. The stress of living with demanding parents and jealous siblings seemed to have gotten to her. It was clear to everyone who had seen her blackened face that morning she was not dealing with fainting spells anymore, but something much more serious. In Baltimore, Dr. Lee O'Connor had seen enough children come through his clinic and felt compelled to document their mysterious conduct. His 34-page report recorded the behaviors of 11 children, quote, whose condition differs so markedly and uniquely from anything reported so far, end quote, and would become the seminal account of a new disorder. Like Asperger, he described the children as autistic, a symptom describing the inward-facing aloneness of schizophrenia, but did not suggest a label for it. As a result, some began to refer to the phenomenon he described as Connor's syndrome. While his account was being compiled, another two children with similar issues had appeared at Connor's office, convincing him something exceptional was happening to infants around the country. In Austria, Asperger had seen many more patients, over 200. He too was concerned and felt compelled to raise the alarm in a paper describing the unique features of the new mental illness he was seeing. His account was officially released a year after Connor's paper, but described many children with nearly identical characteristics. Unlike his Baltimore compatriot, Asperger was clear with his intentions, saying, quote, "I have chosen the label autism," end quote. Because the paper was published in German, and with the confusion caused by the ongoing World War, few would catch wind of Asperger's alert. Two countries separated by thousands of miles with thousands of gun barrels pointed at each other were joined by a very common denominator. They had both recently launched national diphtheria campaigns. They had both begun to employ the recently invented aluminum precipitated vaccines. And they both had Austrian doctors who began to notice a new condition amongst their nation's children at the exact same moment in history.